Hello, and welcome to the Union of Concerned Scientists webinar on the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change Special Report on Renewable Energy Sources and Climate Change Mitigation. My name is Steve Klemmer. I am the Research Director for UCS Climate and Energy Program. Before I introduce our speakers, there'll be a few housekeeping items that I'd like to cover. During the presentation, all participants will be in a listen-only mode. However, you may submit questions to the speakers at any time by typing them in the chat feature located to the left of your screen. We will also conduct a live question and answer session at the end of the webinar, should you want to ask your question directly to the speaker. We'll follow up with instructions on how to do this after the presentations. We will address as many questions as possible in the time available. As a reminder, today's call is being recorded, and we will be making the slides and audio available after the webinar. Now, I'd like to introduce our speakers. Our first speaker today is going to be Dr. William Mumma. Bill is a professor of international environmental policy and director of the Center for International Environmental and Resource Policy at the Fletcher School at Tufts University. He earned a PhD in physical chemistry at MIT and has worked on stratospheric ozone, climate, energy, forests, water, and sustainable development issues for over 20 years. He has served as a lead author for three IPCC reports addressing mitigation options in the context of development and a convening lead author of both the IPCC Third Assessment Report in 2001 and this report that we're going to talk about today. He also has some direct experience with renewable energy. Bill lives in a recently completed zero net energy home in Massachusetts that is powered by grid-connected solar energy and heated by a ground source heat pump. Our second speaker today is Dr. Ryan Weiser. Ryan is a staff scientist at Lawrence Berkeley National Laboratory. He leads and conducts research in the planning, design, and evaluation of renewable energy policies and on the cost, benefits, and market potential of renewable electricity sources. He received a BS in civil engineering from Stanford and holds an MS and PhD in energy and resources from the University of California, Berkeley. Through his work at the Berkeley National Lab, Dr. Weiser has become a well-known expert on the development and design of renewable energy policies. He has published over 250 journal articles and research reports and regularly advises state and federal agencies on renewable energy matters. I would now like to turn the call over to Bill. Bill, please go ahead.
Thank you very much, Steve. Let me begin by just taking a quick look at the the role of the IPCC. Most of you may know this, but it was founded as a UN organization in 1988. There have been four assessment reports since 1990, 10 special reports, as well as the issuance of guidelines on measuring and reporting greenhouse gases and other documents. For this particular report, there were about 110 specialists nominated by governments, but for the assessment reports, there are usually three to four times that number of participants. Each report is peer-reviewed and governmentally reviewed twice. And in one of the most grueling peer review processes I've ever been through, all comments have to be answered, and these amount to the hundreds per chapter each time, sometimes over 1,000. I think for our chapter we had 1,300 the first time and 900 the second. And these all must be answered on a special website. And there are very strict rules for utilization of articles, reports, and data. The goal of the SREN, as it's called, the Special Report on Renewable Energy, was to assess the potential for renewable energy technologies to address climate change in particular. The report consists of six technology chapters and four integration chapters, as well as an introduction, about 1,000-plus pages, plus three technical annexes. It's a critical review and synthesis of the technical literature through October 2010. Comparative data ends in 2008, although there's update when specific information is available. That's one of the limitations of the IPCC process, is there has to be a cutoff time, and that's always frustrating for those of us who work on it. The challenge is shown in this slide, which shows the emitted, the dark blue that's already been emitted historically, of carbon dioxide from natural gas, oil, and coal, and the projected emissions between 2005 and 2100 in the light blue. And then the warmer colors are the unrecovered, both conventional and unconventional sources of fossil fuels. I mean, there's an opportunity to put many, many times the amount of natural of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere as we have already. And this does not even address things like methane class rates and so forth, which are orders of magnitude greater than all of the coal reserves. The greenhouse gas projections given in carbon dioxide equivalents, tons of carbon dioxide equivalents, or gigatons here. This is taken from the fourth assessment report and is what we used as the basis of our analysis. And on the left-hand panel is shown the current trends. That's the dashed line that's rising rather steeply. And then there's a series of possible scenarios that would end up stabilizing at a particular concentration. If we focus just on the green one and then look at the right-hand panel, what we see is that in order to stay between 2 and 2.4 degrees Celsius, that's what's required to stay between about 445 and 490. I mean, we have to stay with between 445 and 490 parts per million. And the 2 degrees is actually a number that has been stated by governments and agreed to last year at Cancun as a maximum amount of warming that would be the governments would like to set that as the target. Unfortunately, that requires a 50 to 85% reduction in emissions. And the reductions must begin no later than 2015. This next slide just shows the role of renewable energy in context, and one has to work both from the upper left-hand box down and around and up from the bottom, because our goal is in the bottom there is energy services and resulting energy needs. And depending on how efficiently we deliver those, will affect both the emissions and the ability of renewable energy to meet its goals. Now, this may surprise you, but there was a huge discussion about what is renewable energy, and these are direct quotes from the report after a great deal of discussion and comments from reviewers. So renewable energy is any form of energy from solar, geophysical, or biological sources that is replenished by natural processes at a rate that equals or exceeds its rate of use. Renewable energy is obtained from the continuing or repetitive flows of energy in the natural environment. And then the third bullet is an observation. We had, again, a lot of discussion about this. Not all forms of natural energy flows are renewable, not all are sustainable, and not all are low carbon. So this creates some difficulties in kind of lumping everything in just in terms of the source, when in fact a lot of it has to do, as the definition says, with the rate of use. One of the things the report does is to focus on energy services. Most analyses of energy and primary energy are top-down, as we'll see in just a moment. They look at primary energy, and all the projections are we'll need this much more primary energy by such and such a year. We instead started at the bottom and said, what are the energy services that are required? And then what are the primary energy sources that could provide it? And there's a significant discussion in Chapter 1, but then pervades throughout the report, on the role of improving efficiency of end-use delivery and technological conversion processes in delivering these. And particularly for renewable energy, I mean, if you think about solar energy, for example, I know from the house I live in, I could not provide all of the electricity net over a year from the solar panels on my roof if I did not have really efficient lighting, efficient appliances, an efficient ground source heat pump, an efficient well pump, and so forth. So there's a synergy here, and there's a large discussion in the report also about the rebound effect and the carbon rebound effect and so on of making energy delivery more efficient. And there's an amazing lack of analysis in the literature on the combination of renewables with efficiency and whether or not there is, what economic factors might reduce the gains that one might hope for. So renewables can provide services with less primary energy for the most part than fossil fuels. And this may seem esoteric, but one of the things that we had to agree on was what method we would use for characterizing primary energy. And it turns out we used the direct equivalent method, which is like the primary method used by IEA for all fossil fuels and combustion, but it differs that all non-combustible sources are treated in terms of the secondary energy delivered. And we'll see that that has some implications. This is just a slide showing the top row are all the primary sources of energy. The bottom row are the different types of energy services. In between are the energy carriers, whether it's a thermal or a kinetic conversion of the primary energy into other forms of energy, the usable energy flow, heat or work. And every one of these transformations, there is a major loss of useful energy. And I think one of the things that really notable is that well over half of the carbon dioxide emissions from fossil fuels are from the waste heat, not from the usable energy of a system. Now, renewable energy is, of course, high on the agenda because the life cycle greenhouse gas emissions are low. This is a monstrous review effort. There is an entire section of the methodology appendix which lists all of the references. So there are anywhere from, 15 to 50 references for each of these sources. These were all evaluated, put together, and given this range of grams of carbon dioxide equivalent per kilowatt hour of energy. And as you can see, the fossil fuels are on the right, and coal is obviously the highest, somewhere around 1,000 grams per kilowatt hour. Natural gas is the lowest at about half of that. And then nuclear, all of the renewables other than bioenergy are very low. They're typically 1 to 5% of the fossil fuels. And bioenergy is the hardest one to pin down. The chapter on biopower is enormous. There's so many different ways of doing it. This graph, the diamonds on here are if one uses carbon capture and storage. So that's how you get some potentially negative emissions of carbon dioxide from bioenergy, is if you use carbon capture and storage. None of these have actually been done. So these are all theoretical or speculated. And the biopower does not include indirect land use emissions and doesn't fully address the regrowth rate of woody biomass for electricity. The shares of global primary energy using this direct substitution method are shown here. The donut on the left shows the percentage of energy from all sources. Oil is the largest, as you can see, a little over a third. Coal is next, just over a quarter. Natural gas, just under a quarter. Nuclear energy, 2%. And renewable energy, about 13%. Now, many people will look at that and say, I thought nuclear energy was actually more like 6%, and that's using primary content, and in our case, we're using the secondary energy from non-combustion sources. So what you see is that, in fact, nuclear energy at 2% is about the same as hydropower at 2.3%, which is the electrical output and gives a more useful comparison for non-combustible sources. Note that the biggest source of primary energy is bioenergy, 10.2%, and about 60% of that is conventional, you know, cooking, heating, and so forth in the developing world. Not really sustainable, certainly. Questionable whether it's renewable in the sense that it's being harvested faster than it can be, it's being harvested and burned faster than it can grow. And about 40% of so-called modern biomass, not all of that meets those criteria either. But you can see other sources are relatively small. These points are just iterated here, and let's just take a look at the share of primary energy and electricity generation. Here, coal is the largest by far, with about 41% of emissions. This is all 2008 data. That's the most recent data, the year in which we can get total data from the International Energy Agency. But here you see that in terms of electricity generation, that wind and bioenergy are both comparable at a little over 1%. Hydropower is, of course, the largest one at about 16%. And other forms are much smaller. Now, there are multiple benefits from renewable energy, and Ryan will talk more about the technical potential and the economic potential and other factors that are leading to the rise in renewable energy. But it can supply a substantial portion of low-carbon energy. It also reduces most other emissions associated with fossil fuels. It can enhance energy security. We found that it can enhance development in poor countries very effectively, and is doing so. It can clearly reduce tension over resources internationally. This is going to be, I think, increasingly important. And when combined with efficient in-use, it can provide energy services at a reasonable cost. So I'm going to stop here and hand this over to Ryan Weiser, who is the convening lead author of the WIND chapter.
Great. Thanks, Bill. And this is Ryan Weiser here. Just as with Bill, my role in the report was both constrained principally to a single chapter, in this case the WIND chapter, but also, as with Bill, had pretty substantial cross-cutting responsibilities. And in my case, cross-cutting responsibilities both for the summary for policymakers portion of the document, as well as the technical summary. And then I played a somewhat lesser role in three other chapters and appendices, chapters 1, 11, and Annex 3. Within that context, I should note that, you know, I have been asked to summarize in the next 15 minutes or so a number of key aspects of a variety of chapters in the special report on which I did not work directly. Certainly, I was involved in the review of those chapters, and hopefully I will convey that work and the key findings of that work accurately over the next 15 minutes or so. But clearly, any detailed questions on those particular chapters may be best left for the chapter authors. So starting with the punchlines for the slides that will follow, a subset of the very basic key messages of the special report, and again, those that I will be focusing on in the next few minutes, are listed here. And they're pretty basic. First, that renewable energy deployment is already increasing rapidly. Secondly, that the global technical potential of renewable energy will not meaningfully constrain continued growth. Thirdly, that renewable energy costs have declined. Further technical advancement will improve the economic potential for renewable energy over time. Fourth, that energy market integration concerns exist but do not represent an absolute technical barrier to growth, and are economically manageable in most situations, at least at low to medium levels of renewables penetration. Fifth, that under certain framework conditions, that the energy scenarios and modeling literature demonstrate that renewable energy can play a major role in future global energy supply and climate mitigation. And then finally, that policy efforts will play a key role in determining those framework conditions and therefore in determining the deployment outcomes. So I'd now like to click through a number of slides that that address those specific points with some of the figures included in the special report and a couple of deviations from those figures as well. So starting with the first key message, as Bill noted moments ago, renewable energy is still a relatively small contributor to global primary energy supply, 12.9% in one of the figures that Bill presented a few moments ago. And that small proportion is especially the case if one ignores the very significant role that traditional biomass plays and has played historically in the use of renewable energy. However, it's also certainly true that renewables deployment has been rapidly increasing in recent years, even if from a relatively small base amount, and that those increases have been influenced, of course, by policy drivers, but also by the declining cost of renewables, changes and increases in the prices of fossil fuels, increases in energy demands, and other factors. The IPCC report, for example, notes that rather impressively, about 50% of the new electric power generation capacity added globally in 2008 and 2009 came from renewable sources, primarily wind, hydropower, and solar. And as a side note, I mentioned that that same 50% figure held in 2010 as well. Also, somewhat importantly, and maybe surprisingly to some, developing countries host more than half of the global renewable power capacity. And, of course, growth in renewables is not limited exclusively to the electricity sector. We've also seen substantial growth in the use of biofuels, as well as the use of renewable energy in heating and cooling networks as well. Now, the next two tables come from a recent REN 21 report, not from the IPCC special report. So I'm departing from script a little bit here, but as Bill noted before, one of the frustrations of an author working on an IPCC document is that invariably near the end you're relying on old data, given the review procedures. You can't introduce new data very late in the game. So to provide some sense for the continuing growth in renewables supply and deployment with more recent data, this figure demonstrates, I think, very clearly that that growth has continued at a high pace in both 2009 and 2010, and that is despite the rather challenging economic environment in which the sector has been placed. You can see that that growth, at least in terms of percentage terms, is very high, not only for wind and solar, circled on this slide, but also solar hot water capacity and some of the biofuels as well. This next slide demonstrates that the geographic spread of the deployment that is occurring has also widened. In the 1970s and 1980s, as an example, the U.S. was really the leading market for many of the emerging renewable technologies, and California in particular. That leadership was largely handed over to Europe during the later 1990s and early 2000s, but more recently we've seen an enormous amount of growth in the use of renewables in China, in Latin America, and elsewhere. And so you can see in this slide that depending on the technology in question, the top five leading country markets often include countries from a number of different regions of the world, not just the EU and the US, but China is heavily represented, as are a number of Latin American and other countries as well. Okay, so off my deviation away from the IPCC report and back to the IPCC report, in addition to documenting the recent growth in the use of renewables, the report clearly indicates that the global technical potential for renewable sources as a whole is substantial. It's greater than current global energy demands, and therefore that the global technical potential itself is not likely to meaningfully constrain the aggregate global use of renewable energy. That's what's really shown on this graphic here. It's a bit of a complicated graphic, and I'm not going to walk through it in detail, but it depicts the range of technical potential estimates provided in the literature for individual renewable energy sources. Those are the bars here. And it compares those potentials to global demands for electricity, heat, and overall primary energy in the year 2008. And you can see that in many cases, the technical potential for individual renewable sources spans or is higher than current energy demands. Now, at the same time, of course, the report indicates that for individual renewable sources, hydro, for example, and in individual regions of the world, that the technical potential may well constrain growth, especially in the longer term. But the report also notes that even in those situations, there are often very substantial opportunities for increased deployment relative to current levels. So if technical potentials are not really constraining growth, what is? Well, first and foremost, of course, historically and up to the present time, the levelized cost of many renewable technologies has simply been higher than market energy prices. This figure, for example, which took really an enormous amount of effort to compile, presents a literature survey of the recent delivered cost of various renewable energy supply options. And the very sizable ranges that are presented here reflect different technologies that are included within each of the technology categories, different world regions, and other variations that might exist from one project to the next. And the figure then shows how those costs compare to sort of typical recent non-renewable costs for electricity, heating, and fuels. And what's relatively obvious from this chart is that in a number of instances, the bars that depict the renewable costs are somewhat to the right of, though they often span, the cost of the non-renewable technologies. At the same time, though, as demonstrated by the fact that renewables costs are often spanning the non-renewable costs, the IPCC report clearly notes that there are a variety of situations in which renewables are already economically competitive. Indeed, those are some of the reasons that renewables have been deploying rather rapidly in recent years, not just policy levers. The report also notes that the situations in which renewables are competitive with alternative sources of energy would grow if one were to consider the external costs of energy supply, for example, environmental damages or other considerations. Additionally, it's rather clear that renewables costs are on a downward trajectory. And because further cost reductions are anticipated due to technical advancements, that the economic potential of renewables is likely to grow with time. In this figure, for example, we simply show historical trends in the cost, the installed cost, effectively, of both solar PV modules as well as wind power plants. And while a variety of factors conspired to increase the cost of both PV and wind from roughly 2003 through the year 2009, the long-term trend, and the more recent trend as well, is towards lower costs. And in fact, and this also is, I should note, is a departure from the IPCC report, a little bit of editorializing, but I would note that some work that we've been engaged with here at LBL is beginning to show that wind costs here in the U.S. have declined substantially since the 2009 data point provided in this figure, or at least are in the process of declining substantially. And as a result, the cost of wind energy in cents per kilowatt hour terms, or levelized cost terms, is now at an all-time low, despite the fact that we saw a sizable increase in the capital cost of wind power plants over a several-year period earlier in the 2000s. Now, of course, we also know that renewable sources and technologies are also somewhat different and unique from their fossil energy alternatives, in large measure because, as Bill noted, renewables are dependent ultimately on natural energy flows of one kind or another. And those natural energy flows can vary temporally, they can vary geographically, and there is also some level of uncertainty in the timing and magnitude of those flows. And those characteristics can and have created some concerns about how to effectively integrate renewable energy into larger energy systems, though I think it's also important to recognize, as the IPCC report does, that such concerns are both location and technology dependent. This table, for example, which thankfully for all of you and perhaps for me as well, I'm not going to try to walk through in any detail, tries to demonstrate that the characteristics of different renewable technologies vary substantially from one to the next. So the integration challenges associated with solar photovoltaics and wind, for example, are very different than the integration challenges that might exist for biomass, geothermal, or hydropower. Additionally, the IPCC report makes pretty clear that those challenges are not absolute challenges from a technical or physical standpoint, and indeed that there are a significant set of various options and approaches that can be used to manage the unique characteristics, especially of the weather-dependent renewable options. Some of those approaches listed here include technology diversity, coupling wind with solar or hydropower, for example, might be easier to manage than integrating wind or solar alone. Geographic diversity to get some smoothing in aggregate output patterns of multiple projects that may have different temporal output profiles. Transmission infrastructure to connect diverse regions. Improved operations or planning methods, for example, doing renewable energy output forecasting. Increasing the flexibility of the conventional generation fleet, demand flexibility, and energy storage. All of these are options to manage the variability of various renewable energy options. In addition, the wind chapter, which of course is the chapter that I was primarily responsible for, we conclude based on a pretty extensive literature survey that the cost of balancing resource adequacy and transmission, I understand that those terms I'm not defining in detail now, I don't have time to do so, but we can deal with that in the Q&A session as needed. But basically the cost of managing the unique characteristics of wind are, when aggregated, add perhaps 0.7 to 3 cents per kilowatt hour to the delivered cost of wind energy. And while those figures are not minuscule, it's apparent also that they're economically manageable in most situations. Now, one of the most important contributions of the IPCC report, at least in my view, comes in its review of 164 different global energy scenarios. These are the results of energy, economic, and climate modeling that's been conducted by modeling teams really that span the globe. And while I did not work closely on that particular chapter, that's not going to stop me. I do want to briefly summarize a few of the key findings of that model compilation and synthesis. And this model compilation and synthesis included a review of 164 different global energy scenarios. And specifically, I'd like to just quickly run through five key points. The first is that the scenarios generally find that there is a significant increase in renewables deployment that would be anticipated, really regardless of the greenhouse gas concentration targets. That is, that the declining cost of renewable energy, among other factors, leads to substantial deployment of renewables by the year 2050, really even in the absence of very stringent greenhouse gas concentration targets. And some of the figures are presented here in this slide. The second, however, and very importantly, and not surprisingly, that the deployment of renewable energy significantly increases in scenarios that have lower GHG concentration levels, though a wide range of outcomes and deployment levels are observed. And so you can see here that in the most stringent carbon dioxide stabilization target level, under 440 ppm, the median level of renewables deployment is about 250 exajoules per year, is substantially higher than the current level at 64 exajoules per year, and substantially higher than many of the other scenarios as well. Thirdly, that there are a large number of low-carbon options, both on the demand side, energy efficiency, as well as on the supply side in the form of carbon capture and sequestration, as well as nuclear energy. And while the models demonstrate a wide variety of outcomes in terms of the competition among those low-carbon demand and supply-side options, it's also true that in the majority of the scenarios, renewable energy is the dominant low-carbon supply-side option by the year 2050, exceeding the contribution of both nuclear and CCS, again, in the majority of scenarios, though there are a wide range of divergent scenarios from those median results. Fourth, that when renewables deployment is constrained from a modeling perspective, Not surprisingly, the cost of achieving a certain greenhouse gas mitigation target increases, and indeed in some scenarios, particularly low GHG concentration targets may simply not be viable, not be possible. So that deals with four of the findings. This particular slide shows the results of some of those modeling studies. I'm not going to try to go through this particular figure in any detail. It's way too complicated to convey in a couple of minutes. Let me move on to the fifth key finding from this model comparison that I'd like to highlight today. And that is that while there is no single dominant renewable technology or energy sector in which renewables are deployed, the majority of scenarios find that bioenergy, wind, and solar energy play particularly substantial roles in future energy supply. That's depicted by the panel of figures presented here. You can see that the growth is principally in those three technologies. In addition, though not depicted here, it's also important to note that in a large number of the scenarios, renewables deploys most substantially in the near to medium term in the electricity sector, with later deployment in, or later more significant deployment, transportation and heating and cooling networks. So the final chapter of the IPCC report addresses policy. And again, this is a chapter that I only had peripheral involvement with, but it will not stop me in conveying some of the key findings from this chapter. And specifically, and very importantly, the chapter notes that under most circumstances, increasing renewables dramatically will require some level of policy intervention. And the chapter also documents the increasing number and variety of renewable policies that have been put into effect globally to increase renewables deployment over the last number of decades. And those policy efforts, in concert with a growing literature that has begun to evaluate those policies in some detail, has begun to help us generate a more robust set of lessons learned, let's say, that are then discussed in the IPCC report about what kinds of policies or policy frameworks can be most effective. And again, summarizing a chapter that I played a relatively small role in, I'd like to highlight six key findings as I see them from the policy chapter. The first is that there are two distinct market failures, economic market failures, that create the rationale for providing additional support in one form or another for renewables. One of them is the lack of pricing for greenhouse gases and other external environmental and other costs. And the second is an innovation market failure. That is, that firms do not fully benefit from innovative technologies that they invest in. That those provide two distinct and important rationales for policymakers to intervene in energy markets to try to develop more globally optimal solutions or resolutions in the energy mix. A second key finding is that while public R&D investments, research and development investments in renewables technologies are very important, that those investments are found to be much more effective when they're complemented with other policy instruments, and particularly with deployment policies that can create sort of a reinforcing cycle, if you would, between technology development and market development cycles. Thirdly, that at least within the electricity sector, feed-in tariffs and renewables portfolio standards have been used predominantly in recent years to support renewable electricity supply. And the chapter finds that both kinds of policies can be effective and efficient depending on design and market conditions, that really there's no one-size-fits-all solution to all countries. Both policies can be effective and efficient. Fourth, that it's very important that one have the flexibility to adjust policies as various things change, technology change, markets change, other factors evolve. It's equally important that the policy design details be the focus of attention. It's not so much that you pick the right policy, it's instead how you design that policy and how stable the policy framework ultimately is. Fifth, that enabling policies are also critical. It's not enough simply to have an economic incentive for renewable energy. It's also important to consider all of the enabling elements that are critical in achieving deployment for renewables. siting policies, transmission and integration concerns, technology transfer, and other considerations. And sixth and finally, that the linkages and interrelationships between dedicated renewable policies and carbon or greenhouse gas policies is an area that is of particular concern and certainly a sizable challenge, but where a marriage of policies, both renewables policies and carbon policies, can make sense if done appropriately and well. So with that, I think that ends my presentation. Let me turn it over to Steve for the Q&A session. Thanks.
Thanks, Ryan. I'd like to thank both Bill and Ryan for their work on this important comprehensive report. It's really impressive. Now I'm going to discuss how the findings of this report connect to some key renewable energy policy opportunities in the United States. Currently, the U.S. does not have a long-term renewable energy or climate policy, and the political climate for putting one in place is extremely tough. Without new policies and leadership, the U.S. is at risk of falling even further behind other countries, as I guess Ryan had showed in his presentation, is already occurring. Federal tax credits and state renewable policies, especially state renewable electricity standards, have been the main drivers for the recent deployment of renewable energy in the United States. We agree with the IPCC report that a combination of deployment policies like these, along with increased R&D and enabling policies that Ryan just talked about, are needed to increase renewable energy and reduce emissions in the U.S. We see at least four key near-term policy opportunities in the U.S. that could help accomplish this. The first is federal tax credits. The tax credit for wind is set to expire at the end of 2012. Some of the other renewable technologies are later than that. But it's possible that an extension of the tax credit for wind and other renewables will be included in the flurry of upcoming funding proposals and debt ceiling fights that are occurring in Congress. As far as R&D funding goes, recently the House cut the Department of Energy's R&D funding by 27% below fiscal year 2011 levels. And yesterday, the Senate Energy and Water Subcommittee restored funding for renewables and energy efficiency back to those FY11 levels. The latest intelligence is that that will likely be retained, the Senate version of it will likely be retained in the full committee, which could even be approved later today. Another opportunity for renewables are around EPA regulations to reduce pollution for power plants and other sources that have recently been issued or are pending for sulfur dioxide, nitrogen oxides, mercury and other air toxics, ozone, greenhouse gas emissions, coal ash, and cooling water. These regulations would help address a key market failure for renewables that was identified by the IPCC by internalizing some of the environmental and public health costs, particularly from coal power plants that are currently not included in electricity prices. Several recent studies have shown that the pending rules could lead to significant coal plant retirements, and we believe that renewables can play an important role in replacing some of these plants along with energy efficiency and natural gas while maintaining reliability and affordable electricity bills. Our primary focus has been on the greenhouse gas regulations. The proposed rule for that is due out at the end of September of this year and the final rule in May 2012. However, the regulations have been under attack and could be delayed, as evident by the President's recent disappointing announcement last Friday to delay the ozone rule. UCS is working with other groups to ensure that the regulations are as strong as possible and implemented in a timely fashion. The other potential opportunity is around state policies. Given the challenges that we're seeing at the federal level, there may be some believe that there may be more opportunities to enact new policies as well as strengthen and defend existing policies at the state level. One of the rationales for that is as an economic development strategy for some states that rely heavily on imported fossil fuels. And there's quite a bit of activity that has been going on around the state renewable electricity standards that have been adopted in 29 states and the District of Columbia. As these opportunities unfold in the coming months, we'll be in touch with you to let you know how you might be able to help. Now I'd like to open up the floor to some questions, and if you'd like to register a question verbally, please press the 1 followed by the 4 on your phone, and you'll hear a 3-tone prompt to acknowledge your request. If your question has been answered and you would like to withdraw your registration, please press the 1 followed by the 3. If you are using a speakerphone, please lift your handset before entering your request. While we're waiting for people to queue up their questions, I'll take a couple of questions that were entered into the chat feature. So earlier there was a question by Peter Golan. I guess this would be directed at, I can't remember who covered this, but he asked if more than 50% of new electric power generation capacity was renewable, what fraction of actual energy production from new facilities came from renewable energy? Bill or Ryan, would you like to try to take that one?
Yeah, this is Ryan. I think that was my statement, so I suppose I might as well try to answer the question. The answer in the simplest form is that we don't know. Global electricity production data are not available, they are available with a couple-year lag, but data for 2009, 2010, which were the years that I was really focusing on in terms of capacity additions, actual electricity production data from those new facilities for 2011, for example, or even 2010, are not yet globally available. And so, obviously, electricity production is more important than capacity additions. And because wind and solar in particular have relatively lower capacity factors or production levels than, for example, a new coal plant, the actual contribution of renewables to new electricity supply may be somewhat lower than that 50% figure, but it's unlikely to be substantially below that, in my estimation.
I would agree with that. I think that's a reasonable answer. If you look at the totals that I showed you up for 2008, you can see that that actually renewables, obviously hydropower being in the lead, are a substantial share now and growing, and that growth rate has been accelerating.
Thanks, guys. Another question by David Bernard is, what is the potential for and barriers to renewable energy penetration directly in the private home sector as opposed to large-scale centralized production, especially with respect to electricity and heat from solar, wind, and other sources?
I can give a stab at that. If one looks at PV growth, for example, the greatest growth in domestic use is in Germany. Over half, 55% or something of PVs, rooftop PVs, are on rooftops in Germany, which is not the most solar friendly or solar usable region. Obviously, a lot of gray days. The growth has been very, very rapid. But there's also been a lot of growth in the central power stations as well. I don't have the exact figures on that, though.
We'll take another question from the... Ryan, do you have anything to add to that before I go on to another question? Okay. There was another couple of questions entered in the chat around sort of competition with shale gas and other new fossil energy sources and what effect that might have on the competitiveness of renewable energy. I'm not sure if that was addressed in the IPCC report, but would one of you want to take a stab at answering that question?
Yeah, I can comment on it. One of the things that we discussed in the report is that the rising cost of conventional fossil fuel sources, initial reaction is, well, that's great for renewables because it makes them more cost competitive. But it also recognizes that it also makes higher cost of fuels like tar sand, oil, and shale fracking also more competitive. And in some cases, those end up being less costly than renewables. So there is remember, it's competition for delivery of energy services, and on an economic basis, some of those unconventional sources are becoming competitive because conventional fossil sources are becoming more expensive.
Yeah, and this is Ryan, and I totally agree with that. Obviously, energy sources face competition with other energy sources. The wind power market in the U.S., though still very significant last year at 5 gigawatts, was only half that which we saw in 2009 when we had 10 gigawatts installed. And there's a variety of reasons for that. There's no single reason, but certainly the dropping cost of natural gas and therefore the dropping cost of wholesale electricity is one of the factors that has slowed the growth in wind capacity additions here in the U.S. And so those impacts, I think, are already being felt.
Thanks, Ryan. Hey, Bill, some of us are having trouble hearing you. If you could speak up, your phone, I think, was fading in and out a little bit.
Yeah, the battery was dying, so I've grabbed another phone. Is this better?
Okay, great. We have a lot of other questions in the chat feature, and I may go back to them, but I wanted to see if there's anyone on the phone that was teed up to ask a question. Operator, is there someone that we could have chime in?
We do have a question from the line of Randall Knight. Please proceed with your question.
Hi there. Interesting presentation. Your report shows that there are no technical limitations, and I guess that's no surprise. And we also know reasonably well kind of what renewables need to be doing for us by 2050 if we're going to reduce carbon dioxide by 50% or more. My question has to do with whether the report addresses feasibility in the sense of, assuming that we are wise enough to adopt all the right policies, we still have technical constraints and economic constraints as to how rapidly renewables can ramp up. So even in an ideal situation, you know, kind of my question is how rapidly can renewables ramp up and what kind of technical constraints are there?
Yeah, I think that this is Ryan, and let me address it partly, and then I'm sure Bill will have some additional thoughts on this as well. The report addresses this in multiple ways, and of course, we don't have a scenario globally in which renewable energy is growing at the pace necessary to achieve particularly low GHG stabilization targets. So we have to acknowledge up front that, you know, we can base things on theory. We can't really base an answer to this question on specific evidence on a global basis, though certainly there are individual countries and markets in which deployment is proceeding very rapidly. But the report in multiple chapters addresses a variety of the challenges to growing renewables supply. Certainly the integration issues, managing variable, somewhat uncertain, location-dependent resources is the primary topic of Chapter 8. Also in all of the technology chapters, as well as in the sustainable development chapter, there's discussions of various sort of social barriers, let's say, to deployment. For wind, maybe, you know, concerns about landscape impacts, property values, noise, things of this nature. The Sustainable Development Chapter also addresses materials constraints. Are there any critical materials used in renewable technologies that might face overall supply constraints in a high renewables scenario? And so there's definitely a variety of places within the document that address not just sort of the technical potential limits that might or might not exist, but that also address issues of economic integration, economics itself, social and environmental constraints to growth, and others.
Just to add to that, there's, as Ryan said, there is information in there about social limitations, information limitations, market conditions, intellectual property issues. All of those things are discussed in there, as well as what are the implications of climate change itself on the flow of energy from renewable resources. So the report does try to address both the opportunities and the barriers. In fact, that's the title of one of the sections, Opportunities and Barriers to the Adoption of Renewable Energy.
Thanks, guys. Is there another question on the phone?
There are no further questions at this time.
Okay. Well, I can. I think we have a few more minutes left, so I can cover a few more of the questions that were asked in the chat feature. There were a couple questions posed around feed-in tariffs. One was, please explain feed-in tariffs and how they support renewables, and the other was, I think, around what states have feed-in tariffs or could have them soon.
Yeah, so a feed-in tariff, you can think of, there are two primary mechanisms used globally to support renewable electricity supply. There's a variety of supplemental mechanisms as well, tax incentives being one of them, but the two primary ones in use globally are RPS programs and feed-in tariffs. Under an RPS program, I'm going to define feed-in tariffs kind of backwards, but under an RPS program, you set an overall renewable energy target, let's say 10%, 20%, 30%, whatever it might be, and electricity suppliers go out and seek to achieve that target at least possible cost. The feed-in tariff is, to some extent, the flip side of the same coin. In the feed-in tariff, you set a price for renewables. You know, wind power plants located in this region will receive, let's say, 8 cents per kilowatt hour price. And then any wind plants that are developed in that particular region would get that 8 cent price. And so unlike an RPS where you're setting a quantity target and letting the price float, in a feed-in tariff system, you are setting a price and then letting the quantity float. Feed-in tariffs are most prominently at present used in Europe and in China. Feed-in tariffs were used in the U.S., in fact, California, perhaps, depending on how one defines a feed-in tariff. California might have been the first state, first or jurisdiction in the world to establish a feed-in tariff. But feed-in tariffs have fallen a little bit out of favor in the U.S., so they have achieved some additional recognition and use in recent years, but primarily for specific targeted technologies and applications. So a state might have a renewables portfolio standard, but say, you know, the renewables portfolio standard is not really addressing some important market segments, smaller to mid-sized PV systems, for example. And so some states have developed feed-in tariffs for those kinds of applications. But really, across the board in the U.S., those states that have developed feed-in tariffs have typically developed them in a pretty restricted sense, certainly in comparison to some of the leading markets in Europe, Spain, Germany, and some of the others, as well as China, which is now using feed-in tariffs not just for wind and biomass, but also for solar.
Thanks a lot, Ryan, for that very comprehensive answer. It looks like we have reached the end of the hour, and we still have lots of questions that are teed up, and thank you for submitting those. We will have to see if there's a way to get responses to some of those out to you. But I appreciate Ryan and Bill's participation, and as well as everyone that has joined the webinar. And I think at this point we will conclude the webinar. And please be on the lookout for some future communications from UCS on some of the issues that we talked about. Thanks.